No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-628-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIO and the number 1. We have a very special guest tonight that we'll introduce in a minute, but first let me say hello to my co-host, Maria Sanchez. Maria, are you there?
I am, and good evening to you, and thank you to our listeners who make us a part of their week. We're really privileged and honored to have this portal into what is our take about what's going on in the world.
Well, that's absolutely true, and let me tell you what's going on in the world, in our little world, and that is that we have 5 new co-sponsors on our statehood bill in the House, which
is
just amazing.
Awesome, Michael.
In 1 week, we've got Lloyd Doggett, who's from Texas 35th District, Grace Menge from New York's 5th, Debbie Dingell from Michigan's 12th, Jimmy Gomez from California 34, and Nanette Diaz-Berrigan, also from California, from the 44th District. And you'll be proud to know, Maria, that California leads the pack with 24 co-sponsors.
And who's the closest behind 24?
New York with 13. So
oh
you guys
my
are
gosh,
way ahead.
Significantly ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, you're crazy California people.
Well, what is the total now?
The total's 151, the most we've ever had. So that's great. And in the House, and 22 in the Senate, also the most we've ever had. So we're moving right along, and that's just great. But so thank you to all those people, and we'll keep you advised of what's going on as things proceed. But tonight we have a very special guest. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Maria.
I was going to ask about Puerto Rico. Have they checked in at all with you lately?
Yes, they have, but they haven't done much so far. They're still getting organized. It's a relatively new thing, the offices they've created in Puerto Rico. Although statehood is not necessarily new for them, the offices are somewhat new. And it's funny because that you mentioned that, because we send out an email blast every week about our show, and actually one of the Puerto Rican representatives clicked on the show this week. So maybe he's out there listening. Pudge Rodriguez, who's a Hall of Famer baseball player and used to play for the Nationals on other teams. So hopefully Pudge is out there. If you're out there, Pudge, call in.
Shout out.
Because we have a very, very special guest tonight, the former mayor of the District of Columbia, Sharon Pratt. And just to give you a little sense of who this woman is, she was the first woman vice president of the major utility here in the District of Columbia, the Potomac Electric Power Company, PEPCO. She was also the first woman to be selected as treasurer of the Democratic National Committee. She was the first woman to be elected as mayor of the District of Columbia. She served from 1991 to 1995. And she was the first African-American woman to be elected mayor of a major American city. She is currently the founder and CEO of the Home Preservation Exchange. And we're so lucky and grateful to have her with us tonight, Mayor Sharon Pratt. Are you there, Mayor?
I am. I'm here, and I am delighted to be here. With all the great work you're doing and all that energy, I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad. We're glad you're here.
Your CV is and, so exhaustive, we have run out of time. I can't believe all your accomplishments.
That's the problem. We can't read her whole resume, or we would run out of time. But, you know,
what
Mayor,
an esteemed...
I would like to start by asking you a question that I really found interesting when I read Hillary Clinton's recent book. Hillary Clinton wrote a book called What's Happened. I'm sure you're aware of it. And in that book, she says something that really stuck with me, that as a woman in politics, she was unable to find ground to stand on. When she was strong, she said they would use the B word against her. And when she tried to take a softer approach, they found her, you know, they would call her weak. And she said that was a real problem for her in the campaign, is finding a place to stand. As a woman in politics who's been very successful, can you speak to that for a moment? Is that a problem, and how do you deal with it?
Well, I certainly think with each generation, you know, the expectations change and the notion of power changes. But in truth, power has pretty much always been defined in very masculine terms. And so I think it is a struggle for a woman to find the ground or the platform or the manner that is acceptable to the public. I mean, look at, for example, Nancy Pelosi that I sort of knew growing up in the Democratic Party. She and I were sort of starting out together. And I think she's proven to be was a very effective speaker, minority leader, but she is constantly lampooned. And it's around her presence, her personality. It's very personal, the attacks on women. So it is a challenge, without a doubt. Some women can get beyond it more effectively than can others, I will say that. And I do think among younger people, I don't think they're as constrained and restricted in their thinking as possibly, certainly my generation.
May I ask, Mayor, who was your role model, or who mentored you, or were you just a trailblazer in and of yourself?
Well, no, I had a couple of good role models, one of whom was Patricia Roberts Harris, who became Secretary of HUD and also Secretary of Health and Human Services. She'd been the Dean of Women at Howard University and then a law professor at Howard University Law School, and she took an interest in me. So that was very helpful because there weren't that many women who were even lawyers then. When I was in law school, there were only 14 women who were in my class, and they generally didn't call on you unless it was a domestic relations or a rape case. So it was such a different world. But, you know, by the time I taught law, over 50% of the class were women. So, as I say, the world is changing.
Well, and that, you know, just to add to that, Mayor, my sister, who would be, if she were still with us, would be well into her 70s. When she graduated from GW Law School, she was one of three women. So things really have changed. And that's an important thing about getting women in politics, isn't it? Because the more women that you get, the more women follow. Isn't that true?
No, I think that's true. And it's clearly, as I say, it's clearly changing. And I think that among younger people, they are not restrained and restricted in that narrow way of thinking. And I think that's all to the good. And I think the style of leadership, although we have seen a big swing from a more collaborative style of leadership to what is considered a more traditional, masculine, authoritarian style of leadership, you know, the pendulum will shift from time to time. But what Hillary Clinton said is certainly resonates with me.
Well, let me also ask you if you could give me some advice, because, you know, you were a first on so many things. And when I ran the first time for office, I made the promise that I would be the last shadow senator. I wanted to the point I was trying to make is that when I leave office, I want to see a real United States senator that has a vote and functions like all other senators. Any advice for me on what I could do that I'm not
doing
now?
Well, you're
doing
great work. I applaud you. I'm quite sincere with
that.
Thank you. Because it is a bit of a, it is a steep climb, and part of the reason I think it's a steep climb is that people in the District of Columbia don't get as animated about it as I would like for them to be. I think as much as one has to be, when you think of the founding of our country, the founding fathers, you have to give them a lot of credit. And, you know, the spirit that existed within the country to take on the greatest navy in the world. And they right. we actually right. pulled it off. But it took a lot of gumption and an indignation to say, listen, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to stand up and assert myself and demand my rights and my full expression of freedom. We have not ever quite reached that level of indignation in the District of Columbia, and that makes it a, so much of what you end up doing is trying to energize the people of the District of Columbia. I think once we become energized, I think the world will take note.
Well, and coming from outside of the box, I keep asking that of the senator, how is it that people aren't more upset? Why is it that they're not making demands? How come they're not doing things that would be activist? And I equated it to the Stockholm syndrome. It's almost like they're just acquiescing because that's the way it's always been. So what can we do?
I think it is a combination of that. And I'm a native of the city. I'm a few generations in the city. And one, you're right. People have had this arrangement for so long. Secondly, when you think of it, for so long, the principal economy of Washington, D.C., and probably still is, has been the government, and you had the Hatch Act. So it was really not smart, professionally not smart, to become politically engaged and politically active. And so people almost sort of looked down their nose at people who became politically engaged. It was so ill-advised. And so that became a part of the culture and the mindset of the city. I think as you have more and more newcomers, people who are accustomed to being real citizens of the country, I think they will be less tolerant of this arrangement. But for people who've lived here forever, they're so accustomed to this arrangement.
Yeah, and you know, we still hear that, Mayor, when we're out there talking to people, that they say things that, you know, things that don't exist anymore, like the federal payment, that, you know, people say, well, we can't be a state because there's a federal payment, which we no longer get, as you know, and we can't do this because, you know, we would lose our tag money, or we would go here, something else would happen. None of which is true anymore. So those old ideas certainly do still exist, and it is a struggle to try to get by those. But let me ask you: you and I share one thing in common. We were both arrested for statehood. You were arrested in 1993, along with Reverend Jackson and Kevin Chavis and Dick Gregory, an incredible man who unfortunately we just lost, and a great statehood advocate. But in those days, people went out every week and protested. They went out every week and protested, and we're not doing that anymore. Do we need to get back to that?
Yes, absolutely. But it was, we faithfully marched every, I think it was every Thursday.
Yeah.
And I always will remember how Dick Gregory frequently would show up. I mean, without a lot of press and attention, he would show up, and so did Al Sharpton. Mm-hmm. They were two who faithfully would appear, as did we, Michael. So, and it helped to keep the energy alive and the enthusiasm that culminated in a, you know, major protest that led to our arrest. But that was all needed as a pre-shadow to, you know, at least we forced them to have a vote on the issue of statehood. And we had a lot of, you know, of course, we had our congresswoman, but we also had a lot of champions like out of California, Maxine Waters. Ted Kennedy was a tremendous friend to us.
Yes, tremendous.
And But, you know, it's hard for other people to get more upset than are we. So having those regular marches, having people energized around it, yeah, I think it really matters. The question is, you know, how do we get them going again? How do we get them excited about such a fundamental issue, a fundamental right? We live in the United States of America, and we don't get to enjoy the prerogatives of being true citizens in the United States of America simply because we live in the capital of the country. It's outrageous.
It's outrageous.
So is it part of your curriculum in the school system in the District of Columbia to talk about the inequity?
No.
And there are people, just like Michael said, they are uninformed or misinformed, I should say, because even when the federal payment never, ever compensated us for the loss of revenue because 40% of the land is beyond, you know, is not taxable. Not to mention the services provided the District of Columbia provides. If there is, for example, a big parade with the military, we cover all those costs of repairing the roads and the police and the emergency, all of which we're proud to do it. We're happy and honored to be the home of the Capitol, but we don't get compensated. And so we have always more than supported ourselves. More frequently, we've supported the federal presence rather than the federal presence supporting us.
Right, and that really is a misconception. And, you know, it's funny that you bring that up, Mayor, because I was just at the Wilson Building, which is not far from the White House, and I watched as they closed down all the streets so that the president could go from the Marriott Hotel to the White House, which is literally a block and a half. But in addition to all the Secret Service guys that were out there, there were 15 D.C. cops. 15 D.C. police officers, all of which we pay for.
All of which we pay for. We do, and all the members on the Hill, you know, whether we have added emergency services and, you know, police protection often needed, you know, on a regular basis, they have their own Capitol Hill police. But, again, it's an honor. It's really the economic magnet for the city. But we're not compensated for the services provided or the loss of income that results therein. So it's never been an economically fair arrangement.
Yeah, absolutely.
So my question is it sounds like there's a generational gap here between what was and what is. And it sounds like there needs to be a primer on bringing people up to speed about what they may think and what actually is true and what once was and what now is.
Well, it's a good point. I mean, it's a very good point. When you think of how bright and impressive this new generation is, a la, you know, Parkland, these young people, and how clever and strategic they are, maybe that's what we need to do is to make certain they are well armed and informed about the history, the unfairness, and the arrangement. And they probably would get pretty upset about it and become indignant. And maybe that could be an added impetus.
Well, it seems to me, because it seems so. It's like unfair is a kind of a misnomer. It's unjust. Seems even illegal, and yet and still it persists. And I would just think that if you could bring everybody up to speed so they all have the same knowledge and information about what is, contrary to what you've heard or what was, how could they not get indignant?
You would think. And, you know, even Puerto Rico, which would be terrific, I think it's a smart strategy for us to be partnered with another venue that seeks statehood. But Puerto Rico is a sovereign entity, a territory. We're not even that. So it's quite so yes, I think we need to, and I say that, you know, in terms of my own, what I did and didn't do is not, you know, inform enough of the younger generation. Probably should have focused more on that younger generation, making certain they're better informed about our plight.
Well, you know, I think we're seeing policies come out of Capitol Hill, too, that are having an impact on younger people that we haven't seen in the past. So maybe that will motivate them. For example, you know, we've legalized marijuana in the District of Columbia, but the Congress has stepped in and won't allow us to regulate it, which is, you know, just crazy. It's crazy that mm-hmm. nobody knows what's going on with this thing. What you know, we should be able to regulate it, tax it, make sure it doesn't get into schools and other things, and we haven't been able to do it. And guns, too. I mean, maybe you can speak to this for a moment, Mayor, but we have tough gun laws, and they're constantly under attack. Eleanor Holmes Norton spends a lot of time defending the gun laws in the District of Columbia. Was that your experience as mayor?
Oh, definitely, because I think it was Shelby's assistant who was killed when I was in office. I think, I don't want to speak out of turn here, but I think it was his assistant, and that really created quite a furor and a desire to repeal all of our gun laws. And of course, we closed ranks and said, "No, that's not happening," and not without a fight. I think what offends me more is often the lack of sovereignty. I mean, here we are; it's our tax money. We're supposed to have some home rule. We make decisions. We appropriate dollars, you know, to support our policies, and then anybody from anywhere, from any part of the United States, can come in and decide, oh, no, I want to change that. I want to tweak that. I want to make you a lab for my notions so I can take it back to my home state. It's pretty offensive.
Well, yeah, and on that note, you know, we certainly have had members of Congress come in and try to do things in the District of Columbia that they don't do in their home states, right? They have laws. They have a certain law in their state, and then they come to the District of Columbia and try to affect our laws in a way contrary to the law they have in their own state. I mean, it's just crazy, and it happens all the time. And I think you're right. You know, it's even gotten to the point where it's insulting. They tried to take away our World War I memorial and nationalize it, even though the kids from the District of Columbia paid for it after the First World War. They paid for it with nickels and dimes that they collected, and it bears the name of the 499 people from the district that gave their lives for this country, and they tried to nationalize it a few years. And Eleanor Holmes Norton had to fight to get our flag, the D.C. flag, included at ceremonies where they brought home the remains of veterans who had fought from the District of Columbia that didn't even come home under their own flag. So it goes from being injurious to also being insulting.
And, you know, because it happens with such frequency, because it's happened throughout our history. And remember, I mean, we do remember in terms of recent history, home rule is pretty new and young.
Right.
It's hard to bring attention to it because it's the custom rather than an aberration. But you never know. One event one day will occur, and suddenly there will be a collective resolve to change this. You know, you never know what that event just might be. But then one day something will happen. And it'll be like the movie Network. Somebody will open up a window and say, "I'm mad as heck and I'm not taking it anymore." I mean, yeah, something absolutely will happen. We for years thought there was no way to ever make any changes in terms of gun control. And, you know, a terrible tragedy. But we've had a lot of terrible tragedies. But those young people in Florida have just been amazing. And they just sort of had a gut-wrenching moment, and they said, "No, we're not dealing with this anymore. You guys may go along with it, but we're not." And their leadership, their resolve has inspired a nation. And you just never know when that moment might occur. And it will occur. It may not be anything we can anticipate in this moment, but it will occur.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that a lot of people probably refused to give up their seats on a bus before Rosa Parks. But Rosa Parks did it with great courage, and she was very resolute, and she did it at absolutely the right time, evidently. Yeah, and then there was an explosion around it, and I think you're right. I think that absolutely will happen. And those kids are coming here, by the way, on the 24th. And when you think, you know, the thing you say about they being so amazing, they're talking about a 500,000 people showing up for this. That these kids in Florida, have inspired a 500,000 people to show up in Washington, D.C., on the 24th of this month.
And they're the first ones who have gotten changes in gun control legislation from a real hardcore Second Amendment governor. It's amazing.
Yeah,
but what I would hate to see though is the I guess it's just the pacificity of it. It's like, why can't we be more proactive? I hear what you say, that a lot of things happen just when it's a perfect storm, and that is what ignites the fire. But it's been so long that this injustice has been endured by the residents of your district, that couldn't there be something that is created organically so you don't have to wait decades or generations more?
Well,
I don't know what it would be.
I'm not sure. I mean, that's why we had the weekly marches. That's why... we had pins that we distributed everywhere, wherever I went, I brought it up to the point that people said, God, can't you talk about something other than statehood? And, I never could find quite the right trigger. We did get to the point where we forced a vote, which was really a milestone. But I never sensed that there a sense of collective indignation amongst the populace that we are not going to take this anymore. It doesn't grab people in the way that all three of us are absorbed with it, upset by it, distressed by it. But the great thing about reading American history, you realize that at the beginning of the country, it was a handful of people who were upset about that arrangement. And it took a while. Where Great Britain overstepped the mark, finally, so that after much conversation by the activists, the Thomas Paines and others, eventually, when they overstepped the mark, it just sort of lit fire. And people were willing to take on the greatest navy in the world, and they were that upset. But it took a long time to keep stoking that sentiment. And I think that's what Michael is doing in his role. That's what has to continue, so that when that moment arrives, there is an epiphany, and people are ready. Are summoned to action.
Well, and I think a problem that we have too, Maria, that other civil rights struggles didn't necessarily have, and that what's going on now with guns doesn't have, is that it's hard to feel our pain if you live outside the District of Columbia, because it's so this situation is so specific to us. In other words, gun violence is all over America, and all America is worried about it. And when we saw, African Americans, I think, all related to what was going on with fire hoses and things in Selma and the other things in the civil rights struggle. But it's hard for people to grasp what goes on in D.C. with this, because we're the only ones that suffer from it. You don't have that in California or New Mexico or New York. That's one of the reasons I think California is so great, that they do get it, obviously, out there. But I think it's hard for people to get it.
And to the extent that you have as many members who have, who have joined co-sponsoring, it's a function of a lot of education and work over these many years. Truthfully, if we decided to shut the city down you know, just block bridges so they can't come to work. That would get, you know, we're the capital of the free world. Everybody would notice. We could get the attention of the world. The challenge is getting the attention and getting our own citizens worked up enough to think that they're willing to make it an issue like that. And I think a lot of citizens don't fully appreciate to what extent we're all adversely impacted by an intrusive federal presence. I think a lot of citizens think, a lot of our own citizens think, that the federal system supports us as against the other way around.
Which is why, could you produce a documentary that you could run on public television or, you know, through NPR or PBS or something where you, again, you educate people as to what it was and what it is and how it affects all of us. I think, Michael, I don't agree with your statement that it's hard for people to feel your pain. I think that's how the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals came about. You know, I mean, people didn't all have pets or animals, beasts of burden, but somehow they felt that they deserved some dignity. And that's what I feel like as a citizen, that you deserve what I have that I take for granted because I happen to live in California.
Well, you know, maybe I overstated it, Maria. Maybe I should have said getting people to focus on it, because you're absolutely right. When you sit down and explain it to people, they're on our side. DC Vote, the local nonprofit that works on this, did a poll some 15 years ago that showed that 80% of America believes that we should have exactly the same rights that they do. But an equal percentage, almost 80%, 79%, think that we already do. Because why would you think that we don't, right? We're the nation's capital. So
there's ignorance, which is coming by people honestly, right?
Yeah.
And then there's misinformation and there's disinformation. And then at the end of the day, it's unfair. And I know life isn't fair, as people like to say, which I hate that statement, but it's not right. I mean, that's just the bottom line. It's not okay.
Well, we have a caller on line one, Denise. Do you have a question for the mayor, Denise? Are you with us?
I want to – I haven't been able to get through to listen, so I might be repeating something that's going on. But I did want to say that I always will remember being arrested with Mayor Pratt after she was in office. So she wasn't doing this for any political gain. She was doing this because of her strong, sincere support for statehood. And it was really a great privilege to be arrested with her during a protest for D.C. statehood. I just have to say she is one of the most eloquent speakers on statehood. When she came to the D.C. Black History kickoff, she just by herself just interwove the relationship between Black history and D.C. and the lack of freedom that we have with no notes. I didn't see any notes. She just spoke from her heart and just a wonderful overview of what statehood and what D.C. history and the connection is all about. And I just want to thank her, and I just hope to hear her on more occasions speaking to the public, because she's so inspirational about statehood and the rights that we should have.
Well, and that's why we wanted her.
Thank you, Denise. Bless your heart. Thank you.
And I'm sorry, I misspoke because I'm an old guy and I didn't hear it properly through the earphones. But that's Denise Jenkins, who's also
Denise,
a statehood advocate.
Okay. Oh, now I got it. I know who I was
thinking
to.
We know her because she's active on statehood.
That's right. I do know her quite well. She's great.
Yeah, and thank you, Denise, for that.
Well, thank you. I have to thank you for having her on. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no argument here. Everything you said, we agree with. So, Mayor, let's give – you've been so gracious to come on the show. Let's give you a moment to tell us about the Home Preservation Exchange, which you started. I find this such an interesting concept, but I'm not sure that I fully understand it.
It was actually an organization. It's a nonprofit that was established in the wake of the foreclosure crisis of 2007 and 8, where an incredible number of Americans lost their homes. And with that, a disproportionate amount of underserved Americans, Hispanic Americans, African Americans in particular, lost net worth, because the average person, only way they really build any kind of assets, net worth, is through home ownership. And it was a very painful, we all know, I mean, we were at the precipice of a complete meltdown in terms of the total economy, but it had a very profound negative effect on many segments of our population. And so this organization was founded and it came out of a two-year study or two-year effort that it was actually financed by Fannie Mae. But we established this group to really raise private capital, which now is a little convoluted here, to buy troubled mortgages. If you can buy the notes, let's say, from a major bank that is, you know, then you have a shot at working with that homeowner to redetermine their, they do a modification of their note in the hopes that they can keep their note, a home, or help them so they can avoid foreclosure. That's really the purpose. So that the many people who were in trouble would be able to, you know, preserve home ownership or at least stabilize neighborhoods. You know, we've raised a good $40 million. We work with other capital partners where we will continue to raise private capital for this purpose. So that's really the thrust of it. We work with private companies, obviously, and we work all over the country.
Well, you know, it sounds like a win-win, because I would think that bankers would really, you know, it costs a lot of money to foreclose. So
it does.
I would think that it would be beneficial for them as well as the homeowners.
Well, it is beneficial. Most of them don't have the patience always to deal with a nonprofit, you know, because our mission is to try to keep the homeowner in the home, and we do really like to make certain the nonprofits play a really strong role in reaching out, because homeowners will return their call when they may not return the call of Bank of America, Wells Fargo. And so it can be a win-win. The challenge is getting nonprofits to work with for-profits and everybody to work with the government and Fannie and Freddie. But, you know, we've had a pretty good a measure of success. And we're still at it because a great many people still are in trouble. You know, the economy is doing better, but for many slices, swaths of this country, they're still struggling.
Mayor and for
Pratt,
our listeners,
excuse me, Maria,
I just want to say for our listeners, if you want to find out more about this, you can go to info@hpexchange.org. I just wanted to squeeze website in there. Go ahead, Maria. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Hey, Mary, does somebody need to be behind in their payments, or can they contact you before that happens, or how do they become eligible to be able to?
They have to be behind in the payments for us to be able to. And typically, we have to buy it from either the bank themselves willing to sell it. And sometimes they're not always willing to sell it. They don't want the hassle of going through it unless you're spending a lot of money buying a lot of notes at once. More often than not, we buy it from HUD or Fannie or Freddie. HUD, as you know, with the FHA loans, basically indemnifies a bank when they're seriously delinquent, so they can get. FHA will indemnify Bank of America or Wells Fargo. And then once HUD had it, was buying so many of these notes during that foreclosure crisis. They had hundreds of thousands of notes. They had to start auctioning them, selling them. Well, then all of a sudden they were selling them to the same some said, the same firms that got America in trouble in the first place. So a great many members of Congress, such as Senator Elizabeth Warren and Congressman Elijah Cummings and others, said, look, you know, no, you need to engage nonprofits more because they're more likely to go out there and try to keep the homeowner in the home. The challenge for the nonprofits is raising the capital. So you, at any rate, that's the biggest challenge for the nonprofits. But when HUD started setting aside a lane for nonprofits, that it made it a little bit more achievable for nonprofits to raise that capital and have that outcome. But you're right. It's a potentially a win-win for everybody. For everybody.
Well, I have another question for you to change the subject a little bit. Since you were a national political leader, worked at the DNC, this is something that haunts me. Who are we going to run in 2020, Mayor? Do you have any idea who is out there? I mean, I hear names like Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren and Mark Warner and Tim Kaine and Kamala Harris, but I don't know. I'm a little biased for Cory Booker because I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and you probably know he was the mayor for a while in Newark before he went into the Senate. But what do you think? Who's out there for us?
Well, they're all potentially very attractive candidates. I don't know. I mean, when you look back on the 2016 election, I mean, there was clearly an intent, a lot of energy around a non-status quo person. Mm-hmm. I think the candidate who seems to represent that has the strongest chance. And I think the intensity, because we are unfortunately a nation that is pretty polarized right now. I mean, it's hard to find that center, or at least one that an operating center. Then I would imagine that someone who appeals to the left in a very animated way, energetic way, would have a better chance. Now, some would argue, well, you've got to be able to go to the center. I think it's a function of who can turn out the votes. So I wouldn't assume that. So I don't have a answer to the question. I think somebody will emerge. There's just too much energy. You know, when you think of the Women's March, I've seen a lot of marches. I was a part of the March on Washington, you know, and it was a very special moment. But it took months to get ready for that, and at that it defied all expectations, both in the numbers and the energy of it, et cetera. But that Women's March, that was organic. I mean, that was organic. And there were millions of women, and not just women, but in so many cities throughout the world. That speaks volumes about a energy and enthusiasm that exists. And it's simply, and not simply, but it's a function of who can tap into that energy. It's not as if it's a we're not in search of the constituency. The constituency is there. The question is who is available to respond to that constituency. And I'm certain somebody will emerge that may be one of the ones you just mentioned. I don't know.
I think that's why Kamala Harris is a great idea.
Yeah,
because
very
she is
well
somewhat
maybe.
Outsider, and this is her freshman session, and she's a woman, and she's of color, and, you know, I mean, her list goes on with her attributes, and she's, you know, great age, and et cetera, et cetera.
Well,
no, she's impressive. She was one of the outstanding attorneys general on the issue of the abuses in the mortgage practices.
Mm-hmm.
She has much to commend her. But, mm-hmm. you know, you have Elizabeth Warren, who definitely is a voice, you know, there, as you spoke of Cory Booker. One never knows. I mean, it's just hard to predict who will be that person. But there is a constituency for it, so I'd be very surprised to see the Democrats wanting for a strong candidate.
And do you think, given what you said about polarization and then what you said about the strength of women, do you think it's a good time for another woman, given that we've just come off the defeat with Hillary Clinton? Is it, you think there's any, I don't know what to say about it, like residual resentment that would hurt a candidate like Warren or Harris?
I think Hillary definitely established that it's achievable, at least in terms of capturing the nomination. I think a woman could do it. Absolutely. I don't know who is that woman. I don't know that because so much can change and the political environment is changing at such a pace. It's hard to assume that anyone who is the strongest today will be the strongest the day after tomorrow, even. But I do think, yeah, it is a perfect time for the right woman to be the candidate. But it would not necessarily have to be a woman. I think whoever can just seem to encapsulate that energy and that impatience with, you know, certainly the more authoritarian style of management and somebody they think who is speaking truth to power. I guess that's really kind of what it is. Someone who can speak truth to power and they think it's an authentic voice that's speaking truth to power and not a practice voice speaking truth to power. And that is, as you pointed out, Marie, that an advantage of someone who is newer on the scene and not as tainted by years of politics, because you just can't be in politics but so long without, having some taint, as it were, just not out of any misjudgment or failure on your part, just by being there, whereas a fresh voice has a good chance. But I think it's that authentic voice that speaks truth to power. That will, and you look at these millennials, I mean, and typically younger people don't vote, certainly in a manner that corresponds to older voters. But, you know, there's a movement out here now, and it could very well, that assumption could get turned on its head. So someone who can energize that voice, so I think we've got a good chance. I really do. I think we've got a good chance. If we try to do traditional politics, or if we try to manage it so that we have the centrist, you know, who can do this and that, I think we'll lose the moment. I mean, look at how Trump just upended all of those candidates. All of those, what is it, 16 of them. And he just did it because people wanted someone who was not a captive of the status quo. They just really were tired of that. They felt that was a recipe for disaster. And so I think the same is true now for the Democrats, that people will want an authentic, unmanaged, authentic voice that speaks truth to power. And who could go toe-to-toe.
To that point, too, Mary, I think we still have the Me Too part of the dynamic that could be tapped into as well.
Without a doubt. No question about it. I mean, that has sustained itself in a way that has surprised people, that it has a power and a momentum that continues. So without a doubt, it's strong in the same way that we've been surprised by the power and force of the students in Florida, Parkland. So that energy is there. The energy is there. But the people who seem to have more credibility are the people who are newer, younger, fresh voices. Maybe it isn't age defined, but it's a fresh voice. And so the young woman among the students in Florida, she's just so impressive.
Right. Yeah.
And when they speak, you see those legislators, they listen. And they knew they had to do something in a way that all these years with the Brady campaign and others, we've not been able to make a dent. But they did. Now, it's the Ella Gonzalez, I think that's it. It was the right time, as we said, we talked about, in the right moment. And there is that voice still.
Well, and they're a very powerful constituency. I always think of the fact that there was a story in the Post a few years ago about a Boy Scout troop that came to the Lincoln Memorial, and they were told about Martin Luther King's speech, and one of the kids asked why there wasn't a plaque there, and the Boy Scout leader said, "I don't know," and they checked on it, and it's because you can't put a memorial on another memorial. That's a federal law. But the Boy Scouts lobbied, and the member of Congress that passed the law that allowed the plaque said, "I didn't believe that there should be a plaque because I believe that there shouldn't be a memorial on another memorial, but I didn't know how to say no to a bunch of shiny faced kids who were trying to actualize their rights you just didn't know how to say no to them." And it's hard, right? Because this really does affect their lives. And I think they're really eloquent spokespeople. Well, I got to tell you, Mayor, we're almost out of time. So I want to ask you, is there something that you wanted to say that you haven't gotten the opportunity to say?
Well, no, I just want to say I do applaud you for your leadership. I'm so pleased to see the numbers of co-sponsors growing. The level of attention that the issue of statehood is gaining. And at some point, and it probably won't be too far in the distant future, it'll become a reality. Long overdue, but it'll be very nice.
Well, that's a perfect way to end. And thank you so much, Mayor Sharon Pratt, for coming on our show. It's been a great honor to have you. I hope as we proceed on statehood and other issues that we can have you back again sometime.
Well, I'm delighted. Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
For all of your inspiration and your leadership and the various capacities of your life and your career.
Absolutely.
That gives all of us hope.
Well, thank you so much.
It's humbling. So I can't tell you how much I appreciate as a woman and as a Hispanic and as a, I'm getting my PhD now at this stage in my life. And so you did it so early. Thank you.
Well, thanks again, Mayor. And thanks, America, for listening. We'll be back next week. And I tried to think, we always leave with a song, and I tried to think of something appropriate to honor Mayor Pratt. And it was hard because there aren't a lot of songs out there about mayors. But so I went back to my old standby, and that's one of our favorite sons, Marvin Gaye. So here's one from Marvin Gaye. And thank you, Mayor Pratt, for helping us understand a little better what's going on.
Well, my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being with us.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a good party, man.
Yeah, brother,
I can dig it.
Stop right off.
What's up?
Hey, man, what's your name?
Mother, there's too many of you crying.
Give the people their right to vote.